That was a section of Amathambo, the title track from pianist and composer Nduduzo Makathini's album Ikambi, which came out at the end of 2017. It's his 8th album overall, and I just kind of stumbled across it last year and was instantly fascinated. There are clear connections between what he's doing now and the work of McCoy Tyner, Pharoah Sanders, Archie Shepp, and Alice Coltrane from the late 60s and early 70s sort of spiritual jazz era. But he's definitely got something all his own happening, and his other albums run a pretty broad range. There's a solo piano disc and one that's a piano trio plus a vocal trio. He's just doing a lot of really interesting stuff. Nduduzo Makathini is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance Podcast, which is part of the OSIRIS Network. If you enjoy the show, I hope you'll consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to create more and better content, so become a subscriber if you can. Nduduzo Makathini is from South Africa. In addition to his work as a musician, he's also a healer, and he's become quite a prominent figure in South African jazz, working as a producer for other artists and acting as a kind of cultural ambassador. This interview was recorded in mid-September when he was in New York to perform with the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra. In this conversation, we talk about his music, his spirituality, which plays a huge role in his art and his life. We talk about South African jazz more broadly, not only legends like Hugh Masekela and Abdullah Ibrahim, but also the current state of the scene. We talk about his friendship and collaboration with Shabaka Hutchings, because he's in the band Shabaka and the Ancestors, and Hutchings plays on one of Makathini's albums. And we talk about the issue of representation, of having to be a stand-in for all of South African jazz. We also talk about the fact that he's recently signed with Blue Note and will be releasing his debut for them early next year. He's a very, very interesting guy with a tremendous breadth of knowledge, and I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. I'm going to play another piece of music now, which is the first movement of Umthakathi, a 3-part suite from Ikambi, and right after that you'll hear my interview with Nduduzo Makathini. Thank you.
use it.
Good, good. How are you?
So great to hear from you.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad we could connect. So
apologies about yesterday, man. I messed it up completely on my diary here.
No worries, no worries. Yeah.
Man, so, I'm so sorry, man. Yeah.
No problem. So how was the show last night?
Man, it was just something else. It, you know, I feel like, you know, although the first one and the second one were two different shows, but it gets better at the level of chemistry, I guess, with the entire orchestra, and like getting to feel each other's pulse and towards this kind of collective sort of memory that, like, you know, is a hinge for this music in a big way. So it feels to me like there is something so deep in our DNA that the more time we spend with each other in conversations and playing the music, we slowly get closer to what it means to really understand this kind of music as, you know, a projection of, you know, various historical narratives and how they find their way into the future, but more in a kind of little pieces of history from different spaces, and of course through displacement, that are slowly like finding a kind of kindredship. That's really how last night felt.
Nice. Yeah, I watched the live stream of the first night. So
Yeah.
So I'm just going to kind of start at the beginning. How old were you when you started playing piano, and was it your first instrument?
Yeah, so basically the piano has always been there at home from at least, I would say, the 90s. So you know, so to see the piano, I started seeing the piano around the 90s, and my mom used to play. She didn't do it like professionally, but she was a professional singer, which she still is. But, you know, she always learned the piano and was, you know, taking classical piano lessons. And, you know, because of, you know, the time that I was sort of born in the 80s in South Africa. So, like, education really became a priority. And it was always seen or thought that if you get too absorbed into the whole music thing, you might not, you know, do well with your education. I mean, in terms of the academics, you know. So what my mom then would do would be, she won't allow us to touch the piano. So, but every Sunday she would play, and I started like just watching her play. You know, obviously I knew I was not gonna get a chance to play, but I just enjoyed just watching her play. And I think those are sort of my first encounters in the 90s, and where I was sort of getting into the piano, like getting into loving the piano, but more from a visual sort of perspective, just, you know. So this one Christmas, you know, like we had the whole family together, and, you know, the piano was there, and I just went and started playing, you know, and everyone was shocked, you know, because I had never practiced anything before. But there was this kind of gratification, and I moved towards it, and from that point then my mom allowed me to play. This was like the sort of late 90s, and then in 2000 I matriculated and went to study music in 2001. So I would formally start playing the piano in 2001.
Uh-huh. And what kind of musical education did you have? Was there like a Juilliard type of a school in South Africa where you went, or?
Yeah, so basically we have a program in South Africa. The main program was the one started by Darius Brubeck, who's Dave Brubeck's son.
Mm-hmm.
And he set up something in South Africa, I think maybe in the 70s, if I'm not mistaken. And this would be the first sort of music department that did jazz in South Africa. So the school that I went to is like a sister school. Then they eventually merged when I graduated. It was all under UKZN. So the program was really, you know, Berkeley kind of feeling. You know, like the syllabus was pretty much borrowed from the Berkeley syllabus.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we studied, you know, anything from like the early 1900s sort of jazz history, ragtime, Scott Joplin, and coming up to the blues, and to bebop, Charlie Parker, post-bop, modal music, John Coltrane, and then into Wayne Shorter. That was part of the study, and yeah, up to now. So it was a very, useful program.
Did there
But the,
was there any
yeah.
it sounds like you're naming a lot of American artists. Was there any attention paid in the institutions to South African
African.
people like Chris McGregor,
No,
Hugh Masekela, stuff like that?
definitely not. You would encounter some of their music through, we had like these ensemble groups, and there was a lady called Susan Berry who played with Busimshongo on Twasa, Ababemu. So she was my first piano teacher, and she really had an interest, and her interest in African music was obvious because she was with Busimshongo. So in her ensemble, you would get pieces of these sort of histories of South African jazz, but also she dealt with the more modern sort of kind of South African jazz from like Moses Mleleko, which is like the 90s stuff, Themba Mkhize, and that sort of music. But other than that, there wasn't any sort of historical sort of juxtapositions in terms of, saying, well, when Coltrane dies in 67, Mankunku records the Akalingoma in 68. So those kind of linkages were not explored. Even just resonances were not explored. So I only got to know about South African jazz history when I finished studying, and I was just looking for something, and I. But I must say, with that being said, I was fortunate enough to have Babu Mbeki Mseli, who was there during the time when I was studying. So, it made it sort of easy for me, at least, to gravitate towards someone like Mokgweetsi Tina, but coming from Mseli. So I needed some kind of close reference to the music, or a kind of deeper connection, and Mseleku was really instrumental even for me to get into Coltrane and stuff,
Your Christian faith is obviously a very strong force in your music. Like, I can see it in the song titles and stuff like that. And in the US, there are some performers who kind of cross back and forth between gospel and jazz, or incorporate strong elements of the one into the other, And I'm curious if you see yourself doing that, and, consciously, or, what, how it works for you.
So religion is a very complex topic in an African context. The reason is obvious, is because of the colonial period and the fact that for a very long time, the sort of pre-colonial modes of worship and religious beliefs and philosophical sort of ideas around faith and that sort of thing were in many ways silenced or removed somewhat entirely in terms of how people cosmology is constructed. So it's very interesting that most of us grew up as Christians. But for me also, what was instrumental was the fact that I come from a Zionist church. So the Zionist church is one of the few churches in South Africa, including the Shembe, the Church of Nazareth, which is a kind of hybridism, so to say, between Christianity, but also it connects with some pre-colonial sort of modes of worship, and that were really around the idea of, ancestral belief or ancestral worship. So Christianity for me was very important in terms of the repertoires that I, obviously they were in my face, so I couldn't escape that. And you can tell with people like Abdullah Ibrahim as well that there is a very strong sort of gospel influence, with that uses a lot of these perfect cadences, and you know. So I'm not too sure if I have a an interest in doing like a purely gospel album, but those sort of leanings are almost a part of me. So I, you know, it's something that comes every now and again in the music. I once recorded an album called Icilongo, the African Peace Suite. So Icilongo is a book that we used to, a hymnal that we used in church to sing. So it was a tribute to that part of my heritage, that part of my upbringing, and how close church was in my life, you know.
You released a lot of material very quickly, like 8 albums in 5 years. So your first two records, Mother Tongue and Sketches of Tomorrow, a lot of the same people play on both. Were they people you were in school with? Like, how did you put your first bands together?
Yeah. So, firstly, with regards to recording at this kind of rate, it's because of my explorations. As you would know, I'm a practicing Sangoma as well. But, you know, so a Sangoma is a healer, you know, in a South African context. So, but most of what I've been questioning is, how do we then think of this sort of healing properties as something that's embedded in sound already? So that is to say, improvisation is a kind of definition in itself. The fact that you're dealing with multiple sort of projections of our reality, and so that's basically explaining why I record so much music, because then I feel like these messages are sort of sent to me all the time, and I sort of have to respond whenever these things are shared with me or are sort of channeled through me. And with regards to the first two albums, they closely related, because like you say, it's people I studied with, but it's also people that are kindred spirits, and it's people that I sort of mentor as well, because I do a lot of that, you know, with Linda, for example, and Sakile and those guys, you know, it's the people that I sort of mentor. And Ayanda is like an old friend. Omagugu is my wife and one of the best musicians I know. And Zuelake, you know, was born in the U.S., but his father is South African. So, you know, every time he came there, so he really grew up, you know, coming to us a lot and playing with us. So, so it's really about how we could think of music as a space for celebration as well, but also as a very communal space where friendships could be celebrated, where family is understood as the one of the biggest sort of components of how the music making processes how we think about music making processes, at least.
You're one of the tracks that really stuck out for me was the track A Believer from Sketches of Tomorrow, because it's like,
sure,
you have a rapper, you have an operatic singer, and then you have like free jazz horn solos all kind of going at the same time. So I'm wondering if you feel like at this point in jazz history, like all styles are up for grabs, you know?
For sure. It's interesting you should speak about that track. I've been thinking about it quite a lot the past couple of weeks. So the thing is, as the title suggests, like, you know, Sketches of Tomorrow is really an idea of what is the shape of jazz to come, as Ornette would have said, you know. So, and I think in my take is that the shape of jazz to come is a totality of music and a dissolving of genre, so to speak. So the ways in which we will define jazz in the future will be dissolving the very idea of jazz, or the idea of hip-hop, or the idea of gospel. And this is something that is deeply embedded as well in African languages, because when I speak about, when I say Ingoma, for instance, which is in Isizulu, which is my native tongue, when I say Ingoma, it's one word that means healing, that means a healer, that means a charm, that means a process of initiation, that means dance, that means singing. So there's a kind of totality that, you know, we've always had. And I think in looking for that totality, there's a lot that needs to dissolve as well into a greater sort of cosmic understanding of life, cosmic understanding of music, so a deeper understanding.
Are you familiar with, because with your, what you're talking about, you know, music and healing and stuff like that, are you familiar with Milford Graves' theories about that stuff? Because he's...
I'm familiar, not with his theories, but I know who he is.
Yeah, he's someone who, he's very interested in sort of playing rhythms that line up with the human body's pulse and stuff like that.
Man, I'll definitely look that up, because I'm really interested in cosmic harmony and the fact that everything is built around an octave, you know, that, you know, the universe operates in the same sort of harmonic, you know, sort of understanding and idea, you know. So I'm very interested in that work, but also I'm currently doing my PhD on music and rituals. So basically at the core of the study, I tried to explore how we could understand the jazz performance as a kind of ritual that sort of overlaps the time-space concepts. So it's something that I'm really interested in as well, but also trying to look at it from a very sort of African and Pan-African sort of context.
It's so interesting to me sometimes, the African approach to live performance versus the Western approach, because I mean, I interviewed King Sonny Ade once, and you know, I saw him play in New York, and he played an 8-hour show. It was from eight at night till 4 in the morning, you know, which is fairly typical for Nigeria. But here in New York, it's like, you know, you get an hour and a half, and then they throw you out, you know.
That's the thing. It's like how we reach the state of trance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's really like the thing in African music. It's like it starts with music, but it must end with it must go into something else higher than the music itself.
Yeah, there's not that sense of, you know, sort of counting off 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm going to start performing now, and I'm going to stop performing in 5 minutes.
Nah, you see, that's the thing. Yeah, that's the thing, man. Like, you know, in Africa, like, it's music is, you know, linked with rituals. So yeah, it's got a very sort of instrumental thing in it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your third record, Listening to the Ground, it's a double CD, and it seems like the music has a lot of sort of autobiographical and personal significance for you. So, I mean, tell me about that project.
So, Listening to the Ground is basically that transition, if I may, where I was thinking sort of deliberately about how music then becomes healing, but also how the idea of healing connects with the idea of listening, and that which is, you know, a big part of our oral traditions in an African tradition, but also what does it mean to listen beyond sound, so to listen through sound as opposed to listening to sound. So that's what Listening to the Ground is about. How do we listen through sound? And if we listen through sound, there's a chance that we might land somewhere interesting, which is not necessarily with the surrounding that we see. So how music then becomes a lens to another world, to another space. So I'm interested in the ancestry realm and the fact that there is constantly messages being sent. So which are kinds of texts? So these kind of texts use musical codes that unlock these kind of realms. So I see like these pages of our consciousness and these sort of layers of what it means to listen and what it means to hear. So that album is really about that. So it paints a picture as well of like the various sort of South African sort of articulations of this music that have developed over time, you know, with a song like From an All Back of Mkumbane. And Mkumbane is a very significant place in jazz history in South Africa. It's in Durban, KwaZulu-Natal. And basically, Mkumbane has a very strong sort of guitar tradition. And a lot of the pianists like Mselegu, you know, myself, perhaps we could think of Themba Mkhize as well, but the ones that are coming from KwaZulu-Natal have a particular kind of signature, which I think, when I investigated, that it really comes from, what do you call it? It comes from a very deep place. You know, that is informed by very strong cultures and very strong communal sense. And I still have songs like Same Mother, which really celebrate the fact that, you know, a mother figure is not necessarily a biological sort of, but the mother is a point of departure, you know. Everything originates from a kind of connection, you know. So then mother as being all these musics that have influenced me. And we have Walls for Chain, which pays tributes to the diaspora and how these sort of musical overtones, if I may, or musical sort of echoes from the continent have emerged and gave birth to something beautiful and something that we can learn from as well in the diaspora over time. And we have King Fela, for instance, a song that pays tribute to Fela Kuti and his idea of the shrine and the fact that music had to deliberately be a tool for conscientizing people and for uniting people.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember some of, because it's a double album, it's got a lot of songs.
Yeah,
and there's Miss New Day as well, which celebrates a new day, but also I personify a new day and into a kind of mother energy as well, this feminine energy, this energy of hope, you know. So they're really different things. And Omakuku as well wrote beautiful lyrics for How Sweet Thy Sound that almost celebrate like the Abe Lincoln sort of contributions to ballad singing. And Supreme Lights, which celebrates John Coltrane. And there is Rejoice Togoza, which means it's a greeting for the ancestors. So there's this constant coming back to the ancestor on that album. You know, there is the now and there is a constant going back, you know, and a going back as a way of moving forward at the same time.
Speaking of ancestors, you played on the Shabaka and the Ancestors album, and Shabaka Hutchings plays on your album, Ikilongo.
For sure.
So were those recorded more or less at the same time? How did that?
Yeah, very close.
How did all that come together?
Same weekend.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I met Shabaka in Cape Town some years ago, and we just like instantly, fell in love with each other's playing, you know. And so I said, "Whoa, man, let's stay in touch." And I had a gig in Nigeria where King Fela, the song, was born in that experience. And I invited Shabaka to come play with me. And then Shabaka came to Joburg and said, "Hey, man, I have this idea. I want to start a group," and you know. And yeah, so at that time I was also recording, so we just like said, okay, well, you know, we share quite a lot. So I played on his record, but I couldn't be on tour with him. But I've just recorded again on his new album, and he's written liner notes for my coming record. So, you know, it's just really this brotherhood, you know, this.
Mm-hmm. So there is going to be a second Shabaka and the Ancestors record then?
Yep, next year. Yep,
next year.
Recorded. Yep.
Okay,
yep.
Cool. Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, were those all his tunes? Did you work on the arrangements with them as well? Like, what, you know, how did that whole, that band come together? Because it's all African musicians except for him, so.
Yeah, so so basically he did all the arrangements. And what so obviously working closely with Sia, who was doing all the lyrics and the singing, but everything else he wrote, except for my part as well, because his thing was that my part must be improvised. So these guys had done two gigs before I joined them in studio. So I had no charts. It was just record, and for me it was play. So I had never heard any of the music. That's what he wanted for the album.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, can you imagine? It's just like all of them had been playing, and I get in studio, and they say, okay, one, two, three, and there was it. Which, in retrospect, I'm like, well, this is not such a bad idea, because ultimately, you know, jazz is about like this initial response to an idea, to a statement. It's about how quick can you respond to it. So all great improvisers understood how to respond in the moment. So that album was a very deliberate sort of pushing into that realm of or register of improvisation.
The your record Inner Dimensions, it's a piano trio and a vocal ensemble, which is a really interesting sort of combination. So
sure.
How was that stuff done? Did you do the vocal writing yourself, or did you work sure. With the singers? Like, how did it work?
So I've always been interested in like the sort of encounters during apartheid in South Africa, but how places like Switzerland became a space for refuge for our people. So you would remember that the Jazz Epistles were, I think, the first people to go to Switzerland in the 50s or 60s, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere there. And Abdullah Ibrahim, this is where he would meet Duke Ellington, and you know, so and Septima Benjamin, and you know, Makai Njogo. So I've been interested in why these particular places, you know, and why these particular encounters between the Swiss and the South Africans. And another example could be the British, and I mean the a lot of the musicians were exiled in London, isn't it?
So, mm-hmm.
So for me, it's always interesting why these particular spaces. And part of this investigation is me sort of creating opportunities for these encounters now in a post-colonial sort of time, where I'm not pushed there because I'm looking for a space. I'm running up, you know, I'm sort of leaving home because of all the turmoils, but I'm deliberately just going there to explore what these encounters sound like. So that was basically the idea. So I had written all the music, I've arranged all the voices, so I did everything on that record, and the musician just came to sing the parts that were there already, but also to bring themselves in terms of, you know, how they articulate things. And as you can hear, sometimes they're singing in isiZulu. That was interesting for me to get like a group of Swedish singers to sing, I mean of Swiss singers to sing in isiZulu. Interesting.
Yeah. The trio,
and the trio
that you
setting
used
as well. I love that, you know. I always feel like, you know, there's so much freedom, and that decisions are made slightly quicker, you know,
mm-hmm.
and more spontaneous, you know. So I love trio playing.
The trio that's on that record, you actually gave it a name, the Umgidi Trio. Is that going to be an ensemble that continues under that name? Or?
Yeah, definitely. I'm doing something with them in October. So yeah, that's the name. So we're looking for a name, and we're like, well, part of what we're doing here is we're celebrating. And and Dominic said, what is a Zulu name for celebration? I said, Umgidi. And say, okay, yeah, that's it. We are that.
Nice. Yeah. You also made a solo album, Reflections, from 2017.
Yeah.
A lot of the tracks on there are pretty short. Were they all composed, or were some of them improvisations? What was the deal? Because it was recorded in like a single day, right?
Yeah, the whole record is a 2-hour performance of just myself seated at the piano. And so the reason why some of them are short is because they were movements. I was, you know, sort of playing towards another new idea, towards another idea. And to package it for an album, we had to think about how we could use certain moments and maybe later release the rest of the record.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually a 2-hour piece that, you know, is cut in, you know, these short movements.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because you don't want to put out, you know, like 2 CD length pieces. I mean,
yeah,
there are people who do that,
much.
But
it's a lot. Already people in South Africa are complaining that I release too much music, so I just thought, well, let me give them one at a time.
Yeah, you, as we said, you made 7 albums on your own, put them out on your own label before signing with Universal for Ikambi.
Yeah.
So what did they offer you that made it seem like it was worth taking a deal? Like, did you feel like you'd gotten as far as you could, just you and your wife?
Yeah.
Or what was...
Partly that, for sure. Just feeling like, you know, I wanted to spend more time just really playing, because running a record label with just me and Omagugu, who's my wife, is quite a lot, and it takes a lot from our savings as a family as well. So, you know, to put out a record.
Yeah, yeah.
It takes quite a lot. So part of it was, well, you know, we need an extra hand, so to speak. But then the truth is sometimes this extra hand doesn't function as the other hands. It doesn't quite function as doesn't move according to the rhythm of the rest of the hands, you know, because it's not easy to understand the processes. Like with me, for instance, I want to play music all the time. I want to be in studio recording all the time. But since I've signed with Universal, look now, it's been 3 years without any record, you know, because they think about, you know, time frames and all of these kind of considerations. But well, I'm learning from that process. And now with Blue Note, you know, I'm looking forward to that, because with Blue Note, I come into a legacy that exists already, that, you know, has been there for a long time. So, and has done this kind of music and committed to this kind of understanding of sound.
So mm-hmm.
I'm excited about that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I always think about the disputes that Prince had with Warner Brothers when he was still alive, and he was signed to them, because he's, you know, he used to complain that he wanted to put out like 3-4 albums a year, and they were like, no, one album, at most one album a year. You know, we'd like it if you'd do one album every 2-3 years so we can, you know, promote it more. But, you know, it was like,
yeah.
He was just like, no, I have all this stuff.
Yeah. Man, you know, for me, it's like that as well. I mean, if it's there, we should just, like, let it out, for sure, you know?
Mm-hmm. Who played on Ikambi? Is it a lot of the same people you've been working with for a while?
Yeah, it is. It is. So on Ikambi, I have... oh, yes, actually, you're right. Ikambi is only Ayanda. And the percussionist from home. The band on Ikambi is a UK band.
Oh, okay.
And also it's those explorations again, you know. As you would know, that I'm really connected to Mselegu as a disciple, you know, of his. So he stayed for a long time in London playing with musicians there. So I thought that was worth exploring as well. So what are some of the legacies that Mselegu has left for us, not just in the continent or the country, but also abroad, you know? So I went there for those kind of engagements, you know, to deeply engage the notions of, you know, collaboration and notions of exile and post-exile, but also notions of home, because Mselegu was very interesting. He recorded albums, most of his albums were recorded in the US, and Celebration was recorded in London. And he comes home to record his last album called Home at Last, which in many ways poses a lot of questions, because on the one hand, when the title suggests that Mselegu is a post-94 sort of feeling, we're back home, and you know, everyone is back home, and you know, so notion of home. And Mselegu, again, didn't get the kind of recognition, for instance, that people like Bam Masekela, Mamire Makeba, and other people got. So again, thinking through what Mselegu might have been thinking was that, well, I've always wanted to come back home, but I'm not getting the reception here. In fact, he did tell me he was not getting the reception. And he was not getting the recognition as well. So he goes back to London. So I'm left thinking that then what is a home? So is a home a physical location? Is a home a spiritual construct? Is home the people that believe in you? You know, the mm-hmm. people that you live with. So I went to record Ikambi there as, you know, because Ikambi in isiZulu means healing. It means a healing concoction, a herbal concoction. So I went there trying to also restore that spirit that Mselegu understood, the idea of home, the idea of family beyond geographic location. He understood it as a kind of kindredship, a kind of spiritualism. So I wanted to explore that in my music. So I went to record in the UK at York University. Mm-hmm. With a UK-based musician, except for Ayanda and Magna Turmotsader is also on Matunda ya Kwanza, which is my trio record, and he's on he's also on Listening to the Ground.
There are two pieces on Ikambi that are three-part compositions, and you've done that on a couple other records as well. I mean, do you have any plans to compose and record like a truly large scale, like a full album sort of work, like almost like a symphony type of a thing?
I would love to do that. Really, I would love to do that. And if it wasn't issues of packaging and, you know, working with record companies sometimes that don't really get that kind of idea, I would explore more towards that direction. Because I really hear things in movements, like you say, a symphony. I hear things, you know, as parts, you know. So I hear the first part. And it's funny because most of what I do is closely related to dreams as well. So it's interesting how my dreams as well are like kind of layers, you know. So I love that approach, and I would love to explore it in like multiple albums, you know, like release a 4-disc album with these movements.
The arrangements too are really interesting in your stuff because they're almost big band style, but then your piano playing is closer to the avant-garde, like in the middle of this big band arrangement. So who kind of inspires you in terms of orchestration and arranging pieces and stuff? Who have you stolen from?
Yeah, he's stolen big time. I'm kidding. So basically, I spoke about the Zionist Church earlier on, but also there is the Sangoma rituals that I attended as a kid. And if you were to encounter that music, you'll realize that counterpoint is a big part of what people will be doing. So there's always someone in the middle, like kind of center, but then there's a secular thing that surrounds that person that leads the particular tune. But so eventually the idea is that everything that we compose, everything that we create, and these are somewhat the laws of the universe as well, that everything we create, everything we compose will eventually get decomposed, will eventually dissolve into a new kind of composition or into a kind of newness. And if you think about rituals as well, rituals are really, that's the concept behind rituals, that you first extract it from a given community, a particular way of understanding, a particular hermeneutic sort of window into this liminal space, which is something I use a lot in my music. So the liminal space is this space where you get lost, where it doesn't really matter, where you do not have to know anything. It's a complete total submission of self into the musical frequencies. And then into this new understanding. So I use arrangement as a kind of way to enter into the depth of rituals. So I learned that in terms of musicians. I learned that from people like Randy Weston, for instance, Don Pullen. Mselegu is a great arranger. I almost think that when you hear Mselegu, his playing is like a big band arrangement. You could just transcribe it and extract it for a big band, and it will sound perfect, it will just sound fine. So we, a lot of the African music, we always thinking of parts. So when we're comping, we always arranging at the same time. So it's this idea that arrangement in itself is a kind of improvisation. So I have an interest in arranging as improvisation.
You've also produced several albums for other artists. So
For sure.
did you study engineering as well when you were in school? Like, do you enjoy the studio process and all that stuff?
So I've got a bit of that in my bag. Yeah, for sure. I studied a bit of that, and it's for me as a producer. What I'm really interested in is to see how you can deeply immerse yourself in one's personal story to a point where it becomes your story too. So that's the process I love about producing. And so over the years, I've produced for Sisa Sophazi, Tumi Mokgorosi, Lindiwe Maxolo, Thandiswa, Linda Skakane, Ndabo Zulu, and a lot of people. So I'm always Omagugu, a lot of her stuff I produce, and a lot of my stuff. So I find it like a beautiful way to, we could closely witness how truth unfolds. For me, that's what it is.
You obviously have worked a lot in the UK. So, what's your impression of the current British jazz scene? Because it seems to take more influence from African and Caribbean music than New York jazz does. So, I'm curious what it's like from somebody who's, not from there, but who's over there,
So the British scene for me, it's quite an interesting one. So because obviously I've not stayed there, like I've not lived, but I interact with these different scenes anyway. So I kind of feel though that like I think there is less sort of I don't wanna put it in a way that might not be understood in the way that I'm saying it, but I kind of feel the collaborative spirit is not as intense as we have maybe back home.
That's interesting because from the view of someone who's close to basically the New York scene, it seems very collaborative to me, like, 'cause everybody's in everybody else's band and, things like that, whereas in New York everybody's kind of hustling and out for themselves,
So for me, what it's about is how when New York, I think, or the US has succeeded for me is in creating all these different schools of thought. And I'm not too sure, and by schools of thought I mean like you hear a musician, they play two bars, and you're like, yo, you come from the Art Blakey school. You hear a musician and they play four bars, you say, okay, well, he comes from an Ellington school. So for me, that's important because it suggests a kind of legacy that is easy to pinpoint, you see? And I struggle with finding that in other places, and I think that so for me, that's what should really define a scene about how it carries itself forward with all of its histories embedded in this moment and in the future. So that for me is important. And it's great to do all these explorations, but sometimes I feel that all the explorations should hint to some historic connection as well. So
Ah, okay, I see what
yeah,
you're
so
saying.
those kind of things, exactly. So I'm just struggling with how to phrase and frame what I'm trying to say, but it's really that for me.
Now, I'm curious about the South African scene because it's obviously, you know, players are well known across the world, at least in terms of, you know, a few artists who have made it to playing festivals in Europe and the US and stuff like that. But what is it actually like at home? Like, are there a lot of clubs and places to play? Do young people come to shows, or is it primarily an older audience like it is in the US? You know, what, how does it work?
So the scene in South Africa is all kinds of interesting. On the one hand, we have these three major institutions. We have like UKZN, we have University of Cape Town, and we have TUT now lately, which is a 20 universities in Pretoria. That so these universities, there are other universities like Fort Hare, but the program, jazz program that I'm currently heading there is new, and that the program is not as visible as the other programs I've mentioned. But the reason why I'm mentioning that is because on the one hand you have such a huge number of, a huge influx of musicians graduating and cats that can really play that come into the market, which is the main market in Johannesburg, which is like, you know, an example of a New York kind of energy for us. Like, you really have to play in Joburg for people to know you exist, you know. So on the one hand, you have that kind of influx. On the other hand, you have a decline in venues closing and a decline in terms of the number of gigs and festivals closing down and all of that. So it's interesting that we have a lot of music, we have a lot of musicians, but there isn't enough space to showcase all of these musicians. And as such, then all these younger musicians that are coming up don't get opportunities, at least in the same way that I feel I got when I was really coming up, maybe around like mid-2000, like 2005, somewhere there, where I, you know, I came in and I started touring already, you know. They don't get to, you know, to travel that much in the same way that the excitement that was there was also colliding with the availability of opportunities that were there. So we lack that kind of thing now. So we start to see a lot of musicians move into like other commercial styles, you know, like, you know, people studying jazz, but then eventually saying, well, I'm going to do like dance music just to make some money, or I'm going to go into like the film industry and do mood music. So the culture of live music is slowly dying. I mean, we have also heavy politics about definitions, and this is not really my thing. I don't really, put a lot of my energy into how people define genres and stuff, but there's a strong sort of usage of the jazz sort of genre for people to sell their festivals, but there are no jazz artists in the lineup. So that's
we get
so
that here too.
You have a jazz festival, there is not even a single jazz musician. And when I say jazz, I'm not meaning in a very intense sort of investigation to what the definition would mean. I'm not even talking syncopation. I'm talking about a jazz festival that doesn't have any live music at all. So, but also there are beautiful things to say about South African jazz in terms of its contents currently, because there was a lot of illusions created by the sort of democratic South Africa, you know, the Mandela sort of period coming out of prison, post 94, you know, we are free, and all of these things. So there were so many things that as South African citizens didn't consider. And part of those sort of problems that were created by that, some of the legacy was the music that didn't have a strong context that links with a kind of that paints a picture of what society is going through. So there was a constant sort of disconnection from, say, for example, from Mannenberg and this meaningful music, Yakalingomo, and all of this music that was recorded in the 60s, 70s, right through to the 90s. So people were just recording what I would call a very light content kind of music, where it was all about just, you know, songs that could sell, that could get cars to dance. So, but we see with the 2009 sort of cases, 2010, where students again, because students are very instrumental in South Africa in terms of, you know, questioning things. So in 2009 we had these campaigns, 2010 we had these campaigns of Fees Must Fall, which were basically saying, well, most black people can't afford to pay these high fees at universities. And as a result, so Fees Must Fall, basically saying we can't pay Mandela and that sort of governance promise free education and free healthcare. So we need that to be a reality, because I mean it's so many years after this was promised and it has not happened, you know. So there was questioning, and there was also the idea of it decolonizing the curriculum, that part of the problem with education in South Africa is that people are struggling to see themselves in curriculum. So why I'm mentioning all of this, because it has shaped how the current jazz generation in South Africa is articulating their music. So people like Dumi Mokgorosi, who's really hinging a lot on the Frantz Fanon sort of text, and very deliberate about how that becomes a hinge in his music. There are people that are trying to look at, like Mbuso Khoza, who's looking at the pre-colonial musics and how we could revive them into a kind of modernity, you know. So there is that, which is very interesting. And it's a bit sad that journalism in South Africa doesn't respond quick enough to these moments, you know. So sometimes I sit and be like, wow, all of this is interesting, but there are no texts that are talking about these things, you know. So I mean, media is pretty much controlled as well, but there are exciting things which are in a strange way, it's excitement that lives in the silences, because there is no media coverage for these stories. For what I'm talking about now, I've not been interviewed for such a long interview back home that goes through my processes in such a holistic way, you know. So there are these silences that are also counteracting the contributions that we're making to this music. But the music itself, for an insider, is quite a beautiful space.
Now, I understand. I mean, you've mentioned you've signed with Blue Note and you'll be putting a record out next year. So what can you say about it at this point? Like, who's on it? Is it all South African musicians, or do you have American guests or anything like that? What's the deal?
So this record, really, the title, you know, as you would know, I'm always deliberate about titling the albums, because I feel like it has to, it's packaging a particular time space sort of code that, you know, is a kind of archive in itself. So I become deliberate about how we title these things. So it's called Modes of Communication and Letters to the Underworld. So the Letters to the Underworld is really an exploration of a metaphor of a letter written by an ancestor. That the belief in ancestors is not an abstract concept, but actually a very logical concept. So I try to argue that ancestral belief is could be thought of as a kind of technology. That's the biggest thing about this album, is thinking about the ancestral beliefs in Africa as kinds of codes that could help us to tap into particular moments of our history, but also can allow us a glimpse of the future. So, and the fact that our ancestors are not dead, you know, but they are there to guide. So they constantly sending these letters. But in order for us to read these letters, they are kind of protocols that we have to understand about the language, the writing, structure, form. So it's a new, it's not a new way, but it's my own way of trying to understand African cosmology in ways that could be explained in scientific terms. And then there is the modes of communication, which is again this idea of communication. But another connection on this album is the bridge that this album tries to forge, which is a bridge between the continent and the diaspora. And it uses water as a metaphor as well, because the same water that was used, like over the Atlantic Ocean through slave trade, I want to create a sort of counter a narrative that says that now people have a choice to travel over this water, and that traveling, that opportunity to come here not as a slave, but to come here as a collaborator, that as a kind of healing in itself. So using water as the bridge for healing. So I feature Logan Richardson on the album.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah.
Who's a great friend, and we really love each other. And so when I came back beginning, when I came earlier this year, when I was playing at the Blue Note, he put together a band with Nasheed Waites, with Bernice Chavis, with Eric Barnett on tenor, and Lissetti and myself. So for me, there was a true sort of picture of this potential of this bridge, and why it's important for the histories that have developed almost parallel from the 1930s in South Africa. The historical sort of records tell us that jazz has always been there in South Africa, which is almost a counter development to how jazz developed in the US. So for me, it's great to see all of both of these cultures find a kind of center and emerging from this space of a commonness, a space of this collective sort of memory. So on the record, I feature Logan, and then I feature Zolake, who's also based here. But it also features Oma Kuku, who's on almost all my records, because she's just this great singer that I always love working with, who happens to be my wife too, so she knows all the songs before we get in studio. And then I have Ayanda, who's an old friend. Under Sikate, I have Linda Skakane playing tenor, I have Dabo playing trumpet, and I have Msaki, who's featured a lot in a lot of the house music back home, but I was just hearing her in a different context. And I have Jose Makgene, who plays percussion, and for me, percussion was important in this album as a mother drum, as a mother narrative, as the center of the music. So quite central to the music is percussion and drum.
So
that's basically the album, and it explores themes that respond to the bigger theme of the album. So I have a song, for instance, called Beneath the Earth. Beneath the Earth tries to think of not having a language to speak to your ancestors as being in a kind of exile, and which restrict both the ancestor and the living beings from a kind of shared language. And I have a song called Unyazi. Unyazi is lightning. So Unyazi explores the energy of fire in the music, that the older musicians always believed that there has to be an energy of fire represented in the music, just in the same way that other songs represent an energy of water as well. So I have a song called Yehlisanu Moya, which is about the current sort of things that are happening in South Africa, this abuse to kids and women and stuff, and Yehlisanu Moya as like a call to the ancestors to sort of bring a kind of healing, but also to bring a kind of light that will help us through some of the colonial legacies, this aggression that came with apartheid, this dysfunctionality in families that came with apartheid, and how now black people have sort of, you know, are echoing the legacies of this heavy hand that was once upon them, you know, without even noticing. So, and then I have songs like Ndau. Ndau is an ancestor's is an ancestor that lives in water. You know, it lives in. It's believed to be a masculine energy that uses water for its presence. So, and I have what other songs? I have a song called Umlayezo Phuthumayo. Umlayezo Phuthumayo is basically an urgent message. You know. So an urgent message, as in, well, in an African cosmology, we have to consider that the ancestors have never stopped saying things to us. So we need to hear those things. Also, there's a song called Emapusheni. Emapusheni explores dreams and the overlaps between dreams and real life, and the sort of shared connections too. I can't remember the rest of the album.
Well, let me ask you this, because you obviously are very connected to, you know, the broader culture and to, you know, the history of the music and to ancestors and stuff like that. But I'm curious whether you're worried, the media culture being what it is, that when you emerge on a U.S. label, you're going to be required to sort of speak for all of South African jazz rather than just for yourself as an individual. Like, does that concern
for sure.
you at all? Or do you welcome
yeah.
that role?
Yeah, I mean, definitely I'll have to speak for, you know, a broader community. You know, I feel like, you know, although I have a very particular interest for my own work, but I come from a community that I understand. So for me, it doesn't bother me much to speak about, you know, sort of broader sort of thinkings behind and the various articulations of jazz and what gives birth to all of that. But I feel as a kind of counter-narrative, what I talk about in my music is necessary for the U.S. as well. And I hope that it just gets as much attention, because it's a counter-narrative. It's not something that you'd hear every day, so I think those kind of narratives need to be vocalized a bit more than what people already know about South African jazz, that it's really about, you know, resistance and you know so you know the old narrative about South African jazz, that it goes against the, you know, sort of colonial sort of, you know, enslavement and all of that. So that's not really what I want to talk about.
Yeah.
And I understand as well that there's the whole idea of the jazz, the commercialization of that music. As much as I'm aware of that, but, you know, I can speak about it, but I feel for me that part of why I'm here is a greater purpose of myself as a healer. As I was chosen as a healer, and that's really what informs my world, you know, so it's this greater purpose. But I'm definitely not outside of a community, so all of these things that I've said, I form part of them too, but I have a very clear sort of direction that I want to go for.
Yeah, it's just a question of, because, like, I know as an American music journalist that to a certain degree, people are going to, even if they don't say it out loud, they're going to be thinking, you know, okay, well, Masekela is gone, you know, we need a new guy, this is the new guy, you know, and
yeah,
so you
yeah,
become
yeah.
the new face of South African jazz or something, and are
for
you
sure.
willing to sort of wear the cape?
Yeah, man, I think, you know, it's important that, in many ways, back home, a lot of the people have put that kind of responsibility on me over the years. So I guess, you know, is something that is part of the work as well, that one has to sort of carry as well. That, you know, there are these legacies that people don't know about all around the world. And myself as a disciple of so many great teachers in the past, beyond myself, I carry the responsibility to make sure that their stories are heard. So, I mean, that kind of position is also natural to a certain extent for any disciple, that at some point you have to carry everything that you are.
Okay, that was my conversation with Ndudizo Makathini, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and if so, I hope you'll consider becoming a subscriber on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us improve the website and the show. Subscribers are now getting exclusive articles 1 week before they appear on the main Burning Ambulance website. So visit patreon.com/burningambulance and throw us $5 a month if you can. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one. Osiris.